From WBUR Boston and PRI, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Buried in the browser wars, there's a bigger conflict brewing about who's going to control the World Wide Web. The war for the web is fought in battles over cryptography, laws, and code. It's a fight over who controls the architecture of the web, who defines the domains and interactions that happen in cyberspace. Popular media hypes the big man theory, software titan Bill Gates maneuvering for hegemony. The capitalist analysis says that commerce will win out in the end. And then there's the populist take that the power must go to the people. Trouble is, there's no template for any of this. Big money and power politics have history on their side. But is it possible that the wild, wild web really is a medium beyond control, the dream vehicle for free speech and democracy? Mapping out the cyberfront, the war for the web, is next on The Connection. First, this news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. It's the preoccupation and the real day-to-day occupation of a lot of people these days to understand the internet and to anticipate where it's going. Our guest this hour, Jonathan Zittrain, is one of those people. He says when most of us look at the internet, we're not seeing the forest for the trees. By concentrating on issues like free speech and defamation or privacy or security or commerce and encryption, we're missing the big picture. Jonathan Zittrain says it's the technology and the people who design and control and make money off it that we should be looking at. The architecture of the internet defines what we can and cannot do online. Too often, we're assuming that the way the net is, the way it is now, is the way it'll always be. We're talking about where the internet is headed this hour and who stands to gain the most from it. Connection this news. Is the internet going to eat your job? Or is it going to make you rich? Tell us about your internet worries, your internet dreams. What do you want most to protect in cyberspace? Is it privacy? Is it free speech? Is it anonymity? Or is it commerce? Do you think big money or Big Brother had designs on the design of the web? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Zittrain teaches cyber law at the Harvard Law School, and he's the executive director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jonathan Zittrain, it's on my mind all the time that everybody I know is talking internet night and day. Everybody wants to be at the right place whenever it is, 2001, when this gusher of money and power kicks in. It's sort of like, you know, everybody's got a chance again to invest in television in 1945 or in Coca-Cola in 1918 or whatever. Where should we be? How should we look at this monster?
I suppose, you know, it really has hit the common parlance when even Homer Simpson in one episode has actually set up his own internet business with the little bird that dips into the water and tips back and forth, and he's not exactly sure what he's doing, but he's ready to make the money when the money is there to be had.
The cash flow hasn't started yet, but it's going to be, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. The network that we know as the internet started as a highly non-commercial venture. In fact, people were fond of saying that the National Science Foundation, which had provided a lot of the money to get the thing started, completely eschewed anything commercial, that you weren't allowed to do anything commercial on the net. That wasn't something that was readily enforced, but it was such a widely understood norm that people didn't even try to explore the money-making potentials of the net until quite later on, say the early 90s. It actually started, some people mark it as a group of lawyers, actually, went on to what's known as Usenet. Usenet is a means of having public discussions over the internet. You can post messages, anybody at large can see them and respond, and you get into discussions. And these lawyers decided to advertise their law firm through it. I mean, it seems like such an obvious idea now that we live in an era of junk email and rampant advertising across the net. The first reaction to them was not pleasant. People actually sought to take out their site. Various people, vigilantes you might say, said this isn't appropriate behavior and shut them down. They were not daunted. They came back, and little did we know then it was the wave of the future.
Now everybody's got a site, and of course it's not the whole story, but internet stocks and speculation about what's going to work in that world is sort of everybody's preoccupation on Wall Street too. But even beyond internet stocks. We have to talk about the sort of the classic internet stock, Amazon.com, say, that has a huge trading activity, even though it doesn't make money yet. But take it even bigger than that. What should we be thinking about sort of on the eve of this explosion?
I suppose with respect to commerce, the thing to think about is, first, the realization that nobody has the formula yet. You have a lot of people trying different things. Some of them are entrepreneurs. They start with a simple idea. They have kind of the Amazon model. They'll build their own brand. They'll get out there and try their own things. And the way the market is, as you've just pointed out, on Wall Street or in the venture capitals of the United States and elsewhere, if you have a good idea, the idea is you go out to Silicon Valley, shake a tree, and a venture capitalist will fall out and promptly hand you $1 million. It may not be exactly as simple as that, but there certainly is plenty of money floating around wanting to invest in any idea that looks colorable in the hopes that it will pay off big. Of course, you also have the big players getting in. Barnes & Noble is the wonderful counterpart to Amazon.com. You kind of have the clash of the David and the Goliath as each tries to build on their traditional base. One, the kind of fleet-footed entrepreneur. The other, Barnes & Noble, building on a brand they have and worrying all the while that for every book they sell in cyberspace, it's one fewer book they're going to sell in the real world, in a Barnes & Noble store.
So how are they dealing with it? I mean, that's a sort of a classic instance. They have real estate all over the country. They have stacks of books, you know, attractively laid out for people who want to walk in and buy it. They can also see the logic is that people are going to dial these up on a machine and get them overnight express any day now. And so it becomes important to figure out what will be left in the way of stores, how long your lease should be on it, this kind of thing, but also when is the moment that it's all going to kick in. Same thing applies, say, to newspapers and classified ads. It'll be much simpler to look for a house on the internet than in the classified pages, or for a job, or to sell your boat, or buy a used car. When is this transition going to come?
Well, there are two things to look for to see when the transition's really going to happen. The first thing is to see when these things called microtransactions is going to take place. Microtransactions are the dream of a lot of internet entrepreneurs. Basically, the idea is you can go to a website, you'll see something that looks appealing, perhaps a recipe for chocolate chip cookies. And that, if it's not in a collection of recipes in a nicely bound volume, isn't something you'd pay $9.95 for, unless it's a really good recipe. But in the meantime, microtransaction says you could click on it, and just like that, you've spent a nickel, and you've got the recipe. And if it turns out it isn't that good, well, it was only a nickel. I mean, it's like not that big a deal. And as a result, the idea is you could have people spending nickels and dimes across the internet, people selling at the price of nickels and dimes across the internet. You could have Uncle Bob designate himself a storyteller, and every night, using technology like Real Audio, I understand NPR uses that too,
right,
read a story to the net at large. Anybody who wants to tune in can. Maybe it'll cost a nickel, maybe it won't. And through that means you'd have lots of little transactions instead of big transactions taking place for which people are reluctant to actually put down the money until they have a brand they
can
trust.
You say people are watching the traffic in microtransactions. What is, for example, what are they watching?
Well, one thing you'd look for is convergence to a single standard. And by that, it means you're looking to see how can everybody end up using the same kind of microtransaction currency, whatever it'll be. If my microtransaction nickels are issued by one quasi-bank and somebody's website who wants to accept these nickels expects them in another, we can't have a meeting of the minds. We can't actually have our deal. And what you basically need is critical mass for one system to step forward and say, this is going to be the dominant system. And you see that pattern repeated again and again on the internet. You have kind of an early stage where there's lots of different standards competing. Because there is no one dominant standard, nothing wins and you don't have progress in the area. And then for one reason or another, it might be pure chance, something comes forward as sort of designated the heir apparent, and then everybody flows to it.
Are the policy, the design, the management, the architecture questions really important? Or, I mean, I think most people's conception of the internet, and mine, for example, is that it's sort of like the architecture of space. It's infinite. Nobody really knew what they were doing. We can all use it forever. And that the action is among entrepreneurs who figure out how to play it. Am I wrong in thinking, I mean, are there sort of big picture actually building that highway, designing it, making sure it's open, making sure it's democratic, et cetera, that we ought to know about?
Absolutely. It turns out that for the longest time, given that the internet was the province of academics and computer science academics at that, there'd be loose confederations, people that got together that just happened to know what worked, and their goal would be the most efficient thing. There's actually a fellow named Dave Clark at MIT who was fond of saying, with respect to the governance of the code of the internet, we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. You actually see this on t-shirts of people in the know now. And that's a system that's now starting to become quite brittle. And the reason is that because there's so much money, and now maybe some policy issues, built into whether the internet goes one way or another, it's difficult for just the engineers to make these choices. One great example would be Dave Clark, the guy who coined that phrase, is working on ways that certain packets on the internet can go faster and others can go slower to their destinations. Now, from an engineer standpoint, this is a great idea. This is the kind of thing where if you're trying to stream audio at somebody, it's very important that the packet stream not be interrupted. If you're sending somebody some documents or email, it's okay if there's a 5-second delay between the first half of
this
email.
This is milk trains against, express trains.
Exactly. So there's a real nice engineering problem there. But in addition, you can imagine, once you have the way to designate certain packets as more equal than others, you have the means of starting to say who was a first-class citizen on the internet and who was not.
If you had to sort of tell, your mother-in-law or a Martian, big-picture questions that you worry about, for the internet, where would you begin? And then we'll go to calls.
I guess I would start by worrying that the kinds of technologies they're developing right now to enable nice commerce, microtransactions is one of them. Others include authentication, so that you know that the person you're talking to on the internet is who he or she says she is. So if Domino's Pizza gets an order for 15 pizzas, they need to know that the person placing the order really wants those pizzas and that they can vouch that that address that's given is where the pizzas can go. Now, that technology, once developed, is exactly the same kind of technology that would let a government, let's say it's Minnesota, say that they don't want their citizens gambling online. They have a policy in their state, you're not allowed to gamble. And they can now fairly ask of internet gambling sites, don't let anybody from Minnesota in. Because you can now authenticate where people are or are not from, that site could reasonably, quite easily say, fine, we'll just automatically stop Minnesotans at the door. That's a different net than people are used to right now. People are very used to just wandering around anonymously and not being able, the joke consistently has been on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And similarly here, maybe you're 16 years old, you can still get to the pornography site. There's no way to know who's 16, who's 21. That could change.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. He's the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Andy is calling from Cambridge.
Hi.
Hello, Andy.
Could I start with a personal question to Mr. Zittrain? It sounds like you've been talking to Lawrence Lessig a lot, what you said about anonymity. He's also a professor at Harvard. Are you connected?
Absolutely. Lawrence Lessig is actually the Berkman Professor at Harvard Law School, and he is a fellow of our center and a dear friend, and very much somebody whose ideas, they call them the New Chicago School, and I suppose I'm one of the many disciples of it.
Oh. It happens he's going to be a keynote at a conference in October that discusses a lot of the things that I think are coming up today. Would it be wrong for me to give a little plug, just mention the conference?
Go ahead.
Okay, it's run by Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. And there isn't anything on the website yet, but very soon there will be, www.cpsr.org. It's going to be in Boston on October 10th, and I'll let it go at that.
Okay, Andy, send us an invitation. We should get to know Lawrence Lessig, too, before we need him.
Well, I'll take you up. Can
okay.
I mention a few things that I consider important
Please.
In the web of the future? I agree that anonymity is worth preserving. That's a really great thing a lot of people take advantage of. Also, Mr. Zittrain was pointing out there'll probably be different tiers of service. If you pay a little more, you can get enough bandwidth to get a movie, maybe. And I think that's a great innovation, and it should happen. But there are some risks on that, and some of them are too technologically complex to get into, like whether small internet service providers can give this service, so whether they'll survive. But one of the major things I like to do is make sure that you preserve the low cost, low bandwidth access that we all have now, like $20 a month for best service you can get. A lot of people point out that the web would never have taken off if people couldn't have this flat rate pricing. You know, you do whatever you want, you stay on as long as you want, doesn't matter. If they didn't have that, they wouldn't have been willing to experiment, and they wouldn't have made the web the success that it is. The other thing I'd like to mention is that it's very important for the small voice to exist. Like the little guy who wants to talk about the Zapatistas and Chapas or something. This makes the web really valuable. And even though I would like to see the Disneys and so forth come online, I would also like the little guy to be reachable.
What's the threat to the small voices, Andy?
What about the small voices?
What is the threat to the small voices?
Well, one threat is that there will be a lot of high pricing. You'll have to pay for your for each bit that you get, as I mentioned, and that would mean that people are less willing to check out somebody who's small and weird and unknown. Another threat is that you just can't find them. Already, search engines are under strain. You can't really find a lot of good things in a search engine. Though I would like to have better search engines, yellow pages, and things that could distinguish, say, between the web, meaning World Wide Web, and the web referring to duck's feet, and the web referring to spider's web, and so forth. If you have this kind of intelligent indexing, then I think it would be easier for people to find exactly what they're looking for, and it would help the nonprofit organizations and so forth.
Jonathan Zittrain, comment.
There's certainly a school of thought, and Andy represents it very well, that when you have unlimited bandwidth, and people think of this now as unlimited bandwidth, so anybody can pretty much put up a website, the next problem you run into is there is not unlimited attention. It's no good putting up a website if nobody ends up seeing it. And technically, people could get to it if only they were to enter its address in. They could type in www.something.com and get to the website, or maybe find it in a search engine. But then you get into these worries that, well, what if the search engines aren't on your side? What if they refuse to list your site?
Right.
And by way of convergence to standards that we were talking about before, it may be that there will only be one or two search engines out there that have everybody's attention. And once those search engines have everybody's attention, those are the ones that if you're not listed, you might as well not even be there. It's kind of like being relegated to UHF Siberia on the TV dial, and people just never quite get up that high in the numbers to find you. That's a problem. What to do about it is another question. I mean, there are some who actually say that you need some kind of almost FCC fairness doctrine-like rule where whoever controls the central space, whoever happens to be lucky enough to do it, maybe it's Microsoft with their startup screen, maybe it's one of these so-called portal sites or search engines, they have to have some judgment other than their own "we'll sell it to the highest bidder" by which to populate that space. Now, of course, that has all sorts of questions it raises as to how would you decide what
exactly. Do the search engines have to list you if you want to be listed? I mean, if you put a Jonathan Zittrain page on the web and I dial you up looking for you, do they have to find you for me?
Well, there are two things. The general way you use a search engine is you go in and you may type in something into a box indicating what you want to find, Chiapas
right.
or something. Those engines answer only to themselves as to what they list or don't list. Now, many of them will tell you, in order to be most useful to people, they will list as much as possible.
Right.
But they don't want to return a zillion hits when you type in Chiapas, because it's just too many. So they'll start going by rules to list the most popular ones, the things they think you want to see most. Those may or may not be the kind of marginal small voice sites that you would have an interest in listing, and you are somewhat at their mercy. The other point is domain names. Domain names are those kind of catchy names, www.something.something, that let somebody get immediately to your site. And the way domain names work, once you've been assigned the name, if somebody types it in, more or less, they're going to be able to get to your site. There's just a big battle now to say who will get the most mnemonic, most easily remembered names and hang on to them.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. Alan is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hi-ho.
Hello, Alan.
Hey, living in my virtual reality with my virtual neighbors who I virtually never see since my face is plastered to another screen. Keep them asking the wrong questions. They'll forever seek the wrong answers. My two questions are, who cares and why do so many people care? Now, Christopher, remember back when things were interesting. Trickster makes the world.
Yes. That was the question.
There's a wonderful book by Bob Putnam, who's a sociologist at Harvard. And
Mr. Bowling Alone, right?
Yes, Mr. Bowling Alone. And he tries to document what he sees as trends, perhaps intertwined with the development of the internet, but he documents it independent of that. It says that basically people are becoming more alienated. They don't have the community groups they used to have. They don't get out that much. And as a result, a lot of their primary contact with the world is in this kind of one-way mode of they sit down, they become a couch potato, and they tune into the television. Some might say one reason to worry, or at least why the internet matters, is that it holds out the promise of actually communicating with people, not just people local to you who could collectively make it to your Elks Lodge on occasion, but people who are across the country and might share your interests and be able to exchange ideas on various subjects. And that is one promise of the internet that helps sort of ameliorate Bob Putnam's problem and at the same time open up new opportunities. So that's kind of the positive reason, at least, of why you might want to care about the net.
1-800-423-8255. Big picture on the technology of the electronic millennium, the internet. 1-800-423-TALK. Douglas is calling from Chatham, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could discuss some major areas that I think need development before the web will really take off. And those would be like speed and access, in the access, and the ease of connecting. You know, I mean, there was a lot of debate over AOL and busy signals. And then the second real areas are reliability and security, or at least the impression of it. You know, a lot of people talk about, oh, somebody can steal my credit card. And in the real world, it's probably a lot simpler to steal someone's credit card, or at least the carbon copy of it. And I think there's some new technologies that are really going to help these areas, ADSL and cable TV for connecting. And in terms of security, the PGP encryption has been really successful.
It's a variety of issues. Security, ease of connection, reliability. Jonathan?
These are good examples of standards that are fighting to emerge. And again, once they sort of dominate, they might be the things that will take the net, as you just started the hour, to the next level. With respect to reliability, it's true. We want to make sure we can get people onto the net and get them on quickly and efficiently. A lot of that is happening. You have a big battle going on right now between your telephone companies. That's the so-called ADSL technology that's emerging. The cable companies, and then people like AOL or other internet service providers, so-called ISPs. All of them want to be the ones who get you onto the net. There'll also be people who want to get you on with wireless. And I guess my sense is this is happening. There are people hard at work doing it. Lots and lots of money is getting plowed into it, including a wiring up of the schools and libraries as part of a federal initiative. And it's around the corner. Interestingly, this is sort of part of a tripartite scheme. The first was fast processors, computers that could think really quickly. The second was fast networks, and that's the stage we're at right now. And the third might be cheap and fast sensors, things that can detect things. The question will be what happens when you get your toaster onto the internet.
I want to know, I mean, especially in the communication biz, but also in retailing, also in education, everybody assumes that we're going to be living on that internet in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You'll go to school on the internet, or you'll do your research on your internet. You'll look for jobs, or you'll buy a house or sell your house on the internet. When people ask you, Jonathan, I want to have my money on the right number in 2002 or whatever, what do you tell them? Who's thinking about it creatively? Who's thinking about it realistically? I'm assuming that the world's going to be a different place in 3-4 years, and that we all want to we all want to survive this transition. How do we do it?
Well, one big question will be whether we end up in sort of an open or a closed environment on the internet. And I can explain what that means. And that sort of will determine where to place the bets and, in fact, what kind of internet it's going to be. A closed environment is one where most of the software on which it runs is proprietary. There's some company that owns it and licenses it to everybody mm-hmm. else on terms that they decide. And where most of the public spaces you see are, again, ones that are in private hands, for better or for worse. And if that's the case, you'd be wanting to place your bets with whomever you think the giants are going to manage to be. The CNNs of the world, the ABCs, maybe even the Barnes & Nobles, whoever is likely to sort of be the singular player in that space. The other vision is one of openness, one of sort of shared code where maybe not everybody, but at least people who are versed as programmers can actually add their own chunks to the collective internet or write their own software that they then share with other people. And in that case, the successful internet is one that's very much more distributed, and the bets you'd place would be with the smaller companies that may not have to strike it really big to strike it big, but can just do a great job in their one niche.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection. Al is calling from Boston.
Hello, Professor Citrine. I was calling because I had a question about you actually mentioned that the internet gambling and you know, the Senate, I believe, last week passed a law stating that internet gambling was essentially banned. And I'm wondering how it is they're going to manage to enforce that in an age where certainly I, as a, you know, internet professional, can simply move to the Turks and Caicos Islands and set up an internet site and have internet gambling, and what's to stop Americans from gambling on my site unless we really are entering the age of Big Brother where the government's going to see everything you do?
Well, without having to call it the age of Big Brother, I think we really could be entering an era where it's a lot easier for the government to regulate the space. And this is something, again, that Larry Lessig has been tirelessly pointing out for a couple years, where basically, true, the internet of today is one where once you get on, you can pretty readily get along anonymously. People just don't know where you are. But, and in fact, the Communications Decency Act, which some people may remember, this was passed to prevent pornography, material that could be so-called harmful to minors, from falling into the hands of children. The way it worked was, it said, if you are an internet website and you are supplying this kind of material, either for money or not, you have to take efforts to make sure that kids can't see it. The argument that was made by free speech advocates as to why this was an unconstitutional requirement was that there was just no way to tell the kids from the adults. So in effect, they were banning this material from everybody because you couldn't single out the kids and exclude them. That is now changing. Basically, some of these technologies, one of the previous caller referred to the speed and the reliability and encryption technologies, these are the technologies that let you authenticate who you are. Some third party, maybe it's the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, can certify that you are, say, above 18, or a licensed driver, or a convicted felon, or not. And those sorts of things that can be certified and then readily verified thanks to the technology are the things that could make it so that a website could single out Minnesotans or Americans from everybody else. Once that can be done, it's not too far a step to imagine government being able to pressure those websites to actually make those distinctions.
We're getting ready for the electronic millennium on the Connection this hour with a big picture look at the internet. Jonathan Zittrain is our guest. This is the Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Massachusetts, working to bring peace of mind through the family plans, and by the MathWorks, sponsoring the Promise Summer Program for future math and science leaders, thanks to an all-company charity auction, a revolutionary place, MathWorks.com.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Listeners support us, along with Dr. Maurice Vanderpoel, saluting the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute for its contributions to psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, as well as providing consultation and referral services. And JNC Adams Company in Cambridge, featuring Anderson smooth gliding patio doors and Anderson energy efficient windows. 800-446-0303. In the forecast today, a hot and humid afternoon ahead. Look out for a thunderstorm either late this afternoon or early in the evening. A high today expected right around the 90-degree mark. Tonight, we'll see a low between 65 and 70 degrees. Tomorrow's going to be partly sunny, less humid. A high expected in Greater Boston in the mid-80s. Other WBUR supporters include Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term and long-term computer rental solutions throughout New England for over 14 years. And Boston Renegades, women's soccer in Framingham, playing the Delaware Genies this Friday night, presented by TJ Maxx. Ticket information at bostonrenegade.com. This is WBUR, Boston, Cape Cod, and the Islands. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered,
Scientists are using a new technique to increase the population of captive elephants.
Pull it back slowly.
Artificial insemination of elephants and the day's news later on NPR's All Things Considered.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the Internet this hour. We're told over and over again that the transformation of involved in an electronic millennium goes deeper even than the Gutenberg revolution or the television revolution. The world, it'll be a new world, a virtual internet world in commerce, in education, in life in a year or two. Jonathan Zittrain is giving us a sort of a general overview and how to get ready for it. He runs the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. A story or two, Jonathan, please, about people who have mastered or learned how to ride this wave or been drowned in it. Well, out of your own experience.
A few examples, and I'm sure many of the listeners will be familiar with them. The first, it's hard to avoid talking about a fellow named Matt Drudge. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Of course.
He does
Drudge Report?
Exactly. This is a web page for which anybody, any self-respecting web designer would go into conniptions upon seeing it. It's basically just Drudge Report in big letters across the top. Occasionally there is an icon of a flashing siren when he has a story he particularly wants to emphasize. And then he just has a bunch of links. It's a great example of everybody else's content assembled under one roof. And people then go to the Drudge Report as a way of first having those quick links to all the other content, everything from AP News to the various publications online.
Monica sightings. And
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also done his own kind of freelance reporting, one where, talk about an emerging standard, because he becomes known as the person to whom people leak, people call him and then promptly leak to him. And he's somebody who has quite proudly said he doesn't filter his news nearly to the extent that Dan Rather would or any other kind of big player, sophisticated media entity, one that might have to worry, say, about defamation laws. And
all the news, whether it's fit to be printed or not, okay.
Exactly, and he's gotten enormous success. I don't know if he's made a killing on it, but he's certainly got enough eyeballs looking at his site that one traditional means of making a killing, which is to get a lot of eyeballs looking at your site and then sell advertising space, is clearly open to him as a path. Now, a couple very
open to him, but has he cashed in on that yet? Has anybody made money yet out of advertising on their webpage?
I think it's largely a shell game. And in fact, lots of the ads you see are bartered. You put my ad up, and I'll put your ad up. And in fact, it is a little bit of a house of cards. There are some sites that consistently get enough hits that they're going to be ones for which advertising placements, again, at least the way the net is currently structured, is something you're going to want to do. Those sites tend to be the so-called portal sites. For instance, Netscape, when you tend to get the browser and set it up, points you quite naturally to Netscape.com and their so-called Net Center. That's how Netscape decided, wait, we're not in the product business, we're not selling browsers, we're actually in the service business. We've got a service called Netscape.com and it gives you information and news and everything else. And they've got a tremendous advantage just because that's where the thing points to when you first set it up. With Internet Explorer, it's the same thing. It'll go to Microsoft.com. So it's some of those sites that are ones that have enough eyeballs at the moment, often predicated because they are the ones who write the software that's in people's hands, a great example of the architecture, that's getting enough eyeballs to actually raise them some money. Question is, can they hang on to it?
Talk about people who've mistimed their entry into this market, including even Microsoft and Slate Magazine. I mean, they have not done what the great Bill Gates hoped they might do, have they?
There's nothing so painful as a really good idea that you have just a little too early. I mean, you would think the key is to be ahead of everybody else and catch the secret before it's common knowledge. But if you catch it and people continue to refuse or just reject the truth that you know is there of the idea, you are left with something that doesn't have a lot of value. And sure enough, the idea that people would willingly subscribe to high-quality news, the idea that, hey, there's so much junk out there, if I can just give them good quality, why, they'll pay for it, just like they pay for their newspaper at their doorstep, so far hasn't panned out. I think that may well be an idea ahead of its time, and that we'll soon see people willing to pay for certain kinds of information. But as yet, right now, people now are begrudgingly thinking, as the suppliers of information, darn, I guess I have to give it away for free and then hope to make it up either in sales, in people paying me to link to their site, sort of, you know, transactions under the table, not illicit, but not necessarily obvious to the consumer. And that's what they're trying to do.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection. Steve's calling from Boston.
Hi, Chris and Jonathan. I'd like to just tell you why I'm optimistic and pessimistic about the internet remaining a democratic engine and not being roped in by commerce. I think that, for one thing, in our culture, the commerce is a is driven largely as a social thing where people go and shop and try on things and touch and feel. And that constitutes a pretty significant amount of purchases that happen in the country. And second of all, I think that what would stop a second internet from popping up if the internet as it exists today was kind of roped in by commercial interests? The internet is mainly just a series of modems connected and servers, so people could just get together and start a second internet. And I just would say that I'm pessimistic mainly because the providers of the service may say to us that, you know, Disney can show us a movie here and there, but you shouldn't be able to show a movie to your friends. So bandwidth leaving your house may be more limited than bandwidth coming into your house. Can you comment on that?
Sure, a couple reactions to that.
Interesting question, Steve. Thank you.
One thought is, I guess you'd call it Walmart or Home Depot syndrome, because I'm totally with you that it's a far more pleasant shopping experience when you come to know your corner grocer, and I still remember the era of corner grocers, and they come to know what you like, would you like your usual, you can talk with them about the products, and it's just not that economically efficient. And of course, if it were really valuable to people, they would happily continue paying higher prices to get that added measure of service. But for some reason, even as we proclaim this, we march right into Home Depot, where shopping, not to criticize Home Depot unduly, some may find it a baffling ordeal. You go there because that's where you're going to find the lowest prices. So there's some kind of hydraulic pressure that says whatever's going to give you the best deal, as much as you think you care about the added service, is what you're going to go to. The second thing about internet commerce is the idea that it can give you added value. Amazon.com is a great example. I mean, it's really fun to go into a bookstore and just browse. It's also quite fun to hang out on Amazon and let it give you certain recommendations. Who knows what engine it's using to say, since you've bought this, you're going to buy this later. But it actually comes up with interesting recommendations, and you can read other people's reviews. That's something you can't readily get to in the bookstore. And then with a single click, it'll be on its way to you. It's an incredibly Faustian sort of thing. You start clicking away.
1-800-423-8255. The internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. James is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, hello. I wanted to ask Jonathan about the focus he puts on the scientific origins and commercial applications of the web, as I think the Berkman Center does in general. What about the military origins and also the whole idea of information warfare that, with this increase in interconnectivity, as well as transparency, you could even call it a kind of technological dependency, that there's a vulnerability, that there are risks of accidents, something like a general accident on the level of a Wall Street crash, that if you become too dependent on it, that we're not even thinking about or aware of yet?
This is a wonderful question, and it's actually captured most recently by talk of the year 2000 problem, which isn't so much warfare, but just, in hindsight now, of course, incompetence on the part of people who didn't bother to include the 19 part of 1995 when they were representing years. And since they only have two digits, the computers will start assuming that we're talking about the year 1900 instead of 2000 when there's a rollover. And it's just a general example of the question of how vulnerable are these networks, particularly as we move more and more of our life onto them. One view has it that because of the military origins of the net, you actually had networks that were designed to be very robust. If you take out a little something, it'll just route right around it and keep up the link. There are, however, central pieces to this network. One example is the domain name system. If you were to take out the so-called root zone, you could bring down, within a couple days, everybody's use of domain names as a way of getting from one place to another. www.wbur.org wouldn't get you to WBUR anymore. My thought is that it's actually the open system that is more secure than the closed, and that is not conventional wisdom. A fellow named Charles Nesson, also at the Berkman Center, is somebody who's actually done a lot of work on this and will be having a conference exactly on information warfare and the benefits of open versus closed systems. But the thought is that the more open it can be, and the more readily understood how the system works, actually the more fixable it is if it were to go down, rather than to try to keep your secrets close at heart and hope that the secrecy will protect you from attack.
James, does that answer it?
Yeah, it does. I was actually, I mean, just right now, when looking at the New York Times, the front page article on, you know, a software flaw that, you know, allows viruses to enter into email. I think, like all new technologies, they create the new accidents as well, and we just aren't thinking far enough ahead about that. I mean, whoever thought about the Titanic, sinking? I think that the level and potential for an interconnective accident on the web is something we're just not fathoming yet.
The real thing, and in fact, what makes it even riskier than the Titanic, is the idea that a lot of the disasters that we're talking about are high harm if they come about, but completely unquantifiable risk. Because they haven't happened before, it's incredibly difficult to assess exactly what risk there is, for example, to our critical infrastructures in the event that some very bright hacker in a foreign land wanted to take it out. And there's plenty of views on it. It's just really hard to be accurate about what the risks are when it just hasn't happened yet. Certainly among viruses, one of the worst viruses is just the idea virus that, for instance, if you get an email titled Good Times, that can bring down your hard drive and cause your girlfriend to leave you, etc., etc. And that's a readily believed thing to somebody new to the net, and itself is a virus of sorts.
James, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection. Michael's calling from Boston.
Hi there.
Hello, Michael.
I had a question. The InterNIC is currently the service which you pay to register a domain name, kind of like you pay states to register vanity plates. It currently costs $70 to register a domain name for 2 years. My
domain name being what follows the www.
Exactly. It's basically what's in between the www and the .com. So for example, WBUR would be WBUR's domain name. Now, my question is, the internet pretty much has a monopoly on this. In April, they said they were going to allow other companies in, but it hasn't happened yet, and as a result, the internet lowered its cost from $100 for 2 years registration to $70. And my question is, and I can't seem to find an answer anyway, is who else is going to get into the domain name registration business? Because it is a very, you know, it requires lots of supercomputers. I was wondering if the professor could shed some light on that question.
This is a great question, and it actually brings together a lot of the big themes about who's
going. It also conjures up this vision of sort of the five-man board of the internet and deciding these things. Who are they? Where do they meet? What hotel room in Chicago can we reach them in?
Well, let me tell you the way it used to be, and then I can tell you the way it's shaping up to be. The way it used to be was you basically had these engineers, you know, at the usual suspect places, MIT, out in California, elsewhere in the world, who would get together, and again, their question would be, well, what works best? And a lot of the things that we now think of as vaunted monopolies were actually big chores. Somebody had to keep a list of all the registered names, and these names had no particular value. They were just mnemonics, and if the one wasn't available, you'd pick another. It was no big deal. It actually turned out that there was one guy out in California by the name of John Postel, and John Postel worked for the Information Sciences Institute, and before that, UCLA, I believe. And he stepped forward and said, I'll take care of this, and started keeping the list. After a while, it became a chore for him because the internet was growing. There were a lot of names being registered. He said, I don't want to do this anymore. And the National Science Foundation, which was the organization that had been trying to steward all this, just put out a contract and said, who would like to come forward and keep track of these names? And we'll pay you a small fee to do it, not per name, but it's kind of a yearly contract. A company named Network Solutions submitted the winning bid there in the end. And Network Solutions is what the caller's referring to as InterNIC. They do that piece of InterNIC, which is registering these names. And they were the exclusive company keeping the list. It does, from an engineering standpoint, at least initially, make sense to have one list and one person keeping it to avoid confusion. After a while, Network Solutions said, say, National Science Foundation, do you mind if we charge a little bit per name so that we can, you know, keep the service up and running and paying for itself? They agreed that they could. And actually, that drop from 100 to 70 that the caller mentioned, they had a $30 kind of, I hate to call it a tax, but an extra fee that Network Solutions was connecting and then forking over for a general fund for the public good. They're no longer collecting that tax, but they're certainly collecting the piece that they are due. So John Postel still retained overall control of the system. He was the guy who could decide whether there was going to be a .biz, for example. Mm. You don't find any .biz addresses right now. And after a while, people thought that it was getting very crowded in .com. In fact, I believe there are over a million .com registries. And when you think in the English language, there are only about 20,000 words. Mm. That's a lot of domains registered and not a lot of valuable ones left within .com. And somebody said, well, why don't we start with .biz and other things? The question is, who is really empowered to do it? Hmm. John was just a guy that people respected. He has no particular authority to do it. And now that it's sort of a million-dollar business, his relationship with Network Solutions has gotten complicated.
Everything's a million-dollar business, and I want to own one. I want to get crass and greedy here. I want you to guide folk about how we can all get rich, if not famous, on the Internet. I mean, if somebody said... everybody's going to be rich out there in the Internet, and I want to be among them. Where would you point them, John?
So here are a couple examples. One is something that even Homer Simpson could do, and that is keep an eye out for domain names coming free. And when they become available, because after all, the people, they're so-called cyber squatters, they'll reserve domains that sound good. For instance, there was a time when Lewinsky.com did not seem like a particularly interesting web address. Well, as soon as a certain intern became of some measure of popularity or notoriety, somebody ran out and got Lewinsky.com. And it wasn't Monica, and it wasn't necessarily Microsoft. Mm. Somebody just thought to be the first, kind of like being the 12th caller on a radio program, they won the lottery and they got Lewinsky.com. And at that point, because they figure people will be typing in Lewinsky into their browsers looking for information, that's a hot property. And they could turn around and sell it to somebody else. So one way, I don't know if you'd exactly call it honorable, certainly among the people in the know, cyber squatters are not particularly loved, is to actually get some domain names and wait to strike it rich.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255. John is on a car phone. Hello, John.
Yes, I wanted to bring up, you know, there's so much garbage on the web, but I want to talk about, serious knowledge and serious research. I just recently joined Silver Platter, which is a company that puts more abstracts, our web service provides more abstracts than AltaVista puts references to websites. But actually, I want to talk about Virginia Tech. Apparently, Virginia Tech, beginning this year, has required that all dissertations now be submitted electronically. And they now have a collection of about 700 dissertations, and they are getting about 500 times more distribution than they would if they were just in printed form. Mm. And it turns out that over half of them are actually not reproducible on paper. And I think this is just astounding in terms of what it's going to mean for serious academic knowledge.
I would say, too. What do you think?
Certainly to the academic, there's heartening news. The great fear of the academic is that you spend years on your opus and it sort of lies stillborn in the library shelf and you sneak in to see if on the library card anybody has checked it out and it's only you.
UMI, University Microfilms, has been the principal distributor of dissertations, and a big seller from them is about 60 copies. And Virginia Tech is finding that their top sellers are being downloaded thousands of times. And there are about 400,000 dissertations done every year in the world. And imagine all of those actually being available. I mean, these are people who have taken some body of knowledge to the stage of the leading edge. And now being able to have that be accessible to people around the world is, I think, just a phenomenal... It shows how the Internet is actually like the Gutenberg. It's completely changing the dynamics of human communication.
John, well said.
And for free at that. These are people who are willing to give away their work rather than actually charge for it. It actually says that maybe .com isn't the only future for the net. You could have .edu or .org actually have a place at the table.
1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Cambridge.
Hi.
Hello, David.
You had mentioned electronic cash before, and I wanted to just get into the discussion the fact that there's essentially two ways to do this. One is where the way that the Visas and MasterCards are pushing right now, which is that essentially a credit card bank would be the clearinghouse for all these microtransactions that you were talking about. The other is, and I was just looking it up on the web and didn't find it in time, but there was an article in Wired a year or so ago about Denmark having a sort of a citizen-based electronic cash system that where essentially the information about your transactions resides with you rather than with the credit card companies. And I think those form two fundamentally different ways of viewing how we will do commerce on the net, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, certainly when you think of electronic cash, what makes it different from just using your credit card online and having that be the means by which you buy certain things is the idea that electronic cash could allow for anonymous transactions. Thanks to this idea of a third party being able to authenticate certain things about you, but not necessarily having to authenticate other things, It's the perfect way for a third party, that bank in Denmark, to say, yes, this person is good for the $20, but we don't even know who this person is. They've simply presented us sufficient credential to say they're good for the $20. In fact, it's in the real world what happens when you hand cash over the counter at store 24 or something. Somebody looks at the cash and they say, I don't know who this person is, but sure enough, their money's good with me. And anonymous cash transactions are what they're really aiming for with some of this stuff. And it's maybe even transactions in which you can exact whatever tax is due. See, government is worrying that they're going to lose a big base of tax revenue from sales tax, or in Europe, VAT. This is a way of just build it into the transaction. Just parcel out a little piece of that money, and off it goes to the government.
Last caller is Jake on the payphone.
Hello.
Is this call paid, Jake? Okay.
I wanted to briefly comment on sort of the status of security on the internet right now. Not specifically privacy, anonymity, and that sort of thing, but more the on a technical level. Basically, how the majority of users on the internet, they don't. I don't think they quite grasp the. Just the magnitude of the problem of security.
Let Jonathan Zittrain take a crack at it. We're running out of time. Thank you. Thank you, Jake.
My own inclination right now is that people as consumers, are about as worried about security as they need to be. There ought to be people, you know, that are building the stuff that make sure they worry about it. But the consumer, hey, you can use that credit card. There's a $50 limit to your liability. The credit card companies aren't necessarily fond of telling you that, but it'll work itself out.
Thank you, callers. Thank you, Jonathan Zittrain. This is interesting. We're going to come back to it. We want to thrive on the internet, all of us, the connection especially. Jonathan Zittrain teaches cyber law at the Harvard Law School, and he runs the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
We also had help today from Rachel Burstein, John Dana, Corey Luders, and Kim Bichari. The connection is produced by Louis Cronin, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Keith Shields, and Tina Toby. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.